So I think I'm going to talk here for about 45 minutes, and then hopefully we'll open up to questions. But I totally encourage people to ask me a question if there's a clarification or something, you know, marvelous pops up. I really like to do this mostly as a way to seed dialogue. So please feel free to chime in. So I want to start off with the idea that that the visionary, on some level at least, is what we are, and not in a kind of woo-woo way, but that actually the way that we perceive the world is in a continuum with visionary experience and what the visionary means. And to get there, I want to go through a lot of different senses of what we mean by the term. It's one that fascinates me, both in terms of the different kinds of things that it can refer to, the visionary, but also how it drifts through society and culture, how it's used in the mainstream media and used by people to try to describe different kinds of things that are very difficult to get a hold of. And I think that the visionary also has a very rich history to it. So I want to kind of go into the words a little bit more. What do we mean by visionary, and what do we mean by practice? Not as a way to get caught up in the words, but as to see the depth and the resonance, because of course language itself is, or can be, a visionary medium. The images that come even literally with reading poetry or a fine piece of prose, or the sense of enchantment that a spell or a great ritual or a great invocation can produce, these all show the ways that language itself can be a medium of vision, even as it can also be a medium of the mundane or the technical or the all too ordinary. So I want to play a little bit with what this word is. Think about the things that often accompany visionary. We have visionary art, visionary poetry, visionary plants, visionary experience. And then we also have the sense of the visionary that you find increasingly in popular discourse. Like if you come across the word visionary in Time magazine, it's usually not talking about an Iowa Scarrow or William Blake. Usually it's talking about an entrepreneur. But I think it's actually a very interesting usage of the term that tells us something. It tells us something about one aspect of the visionary, which has to do with novelty, and it has to do with being able to synthesize something new out of the bits and pieces of possibilities and realities. So I just want to go through a little bit and talk a little more about how we might define different senses of the visionary. One, of course, is just having visions, meaning seeing things that aren't quite there, or at least aren't there the way that ordinary objects seem to assert themselves. Dreams are, of course, the most obvious example of a kind of visionary experience that we were talking about last night that happens all the time, and I think dreams are going to be a thread that weave through the whole weekend. But I want to think a little bit more about the kinds of visions that we might perceive under ordinary circumstances in our daily lives. I think the most obvious example that we can all know, at least from being kids, and then if we're lucky or chilled out enough, we can experience as adults, is the phenomenon of seeing faces in clouds or sandstone rock formations. Certainly true for me, and I think it's true for a lot of people, that you used to be able to do that more when you were a kid. If you can remember being a kid, you could look up at the clouds and you'd see a whole story. And I remember one of the great gifts, or sort of secondary gifts of meditation that I've ever had, was during a Zen session. It was a break time, and I went out and to do some stretching, and it was a beautiful day like this, although there were an unusual number of cumulus clouds that were hurtling through the sky over the Bay Area, which we don't usually get. So I was looking at these, and then something in my mind switched, and I was 5 years old, and I watched an entire cartoon, coyotes and western landscapes and Indians and dragons all morphing and shifting. Well, it's a fascinating thing that we can do. It's a fascinating thing that we can look at a sandstone and see a vision. And I'm really, part of what I'm trying to do here is to bring the visionary away from huge empyrean, extraordinary visions that that we can occasionally stumble into, sometimes through our relationships with various helpers, to almost a more ordinary or ground or everyday sense of the vision. And I think that the faces in clouds is a really interesting one. There's some, I think, a good amount of evidence that we have a completely understandable tendency to see the patterns of faces. So that when you deal with kids and they do studies with, you know, things that have vaguely two eyes and vaguely a mouth, there's an attraction to this, and it makes a lot of sense because that's more likely to be mom and more likely to get me some food. And so we have a very hardwired tendency to see faces. But that's not a way to reduce the phenomenon, because of course when it happens to you, when you actually see that glimpse, there's something that is happening in reality. You're having this visionary experience. It's coming through directly, because it's not just a face, it's a character. That has a certain quality. It's an old man, it's a wise woman, it's a kind of impish elf. Whatever it is, there's a sort of imaginative force in this very simple experience of seeing faces in clouds. And that ability to see a pattern or a pattern form out of what is technically noise or random bunts of images and marks on a tree, you know, has to do with our ability to see patterns. And that's a really remarkable thing about human consciousness, is our ability to see patterns, both literal morphological patterns, but also a deeper sense of how things interrelate, how things interconnect, how things are brought together. And once again, there's some really interesting studies that I've come across about this. One is that, and you know, with these studies, you never know exactly how they're working. Sometimes the more you look at the way they've done it, it's a little bit iffy. And so you run with ones that you like. But, you know, I haven't done the backup on this one. But it still is a very interesting one, which is that people vary quite dramatically in their ability to recognize patterns. And that there is a correlation, according to a couple studies, that between people's tendency to believe in religious or supernatural ideas and their abilities to perceive pattern. Very interesting. Very interesting. So on the one hand...
Positive correlation.
Positive correlation. And on the one hand, you know, you have the resistance to fantasy, the resistance to a face appearing on a cloud, because you know, after all, that it's simply a cloud, that it's merely composed of these random elements that are changing. And then on the other side, you have people who just see this stuff everywhere. And I think we've all known people like that. And maybe it's they're tapped into the higher forces, and maybe it's just the way their nervous system is organized. But it's clearly the case, as we all know, that people have different kinds of temperaments in terms of this very, you know, specific ability to see visions. The idea that there's some correlation between that and supernatural or religious thinking makes a lot of sense. It's certainly true if you think about the way we perceive interconnection or synchronicity. Because part of seeing pattern isn't just literally being able to see a visual pattern. It's also being able to pick out a pattern of events and have it seem like it has some meaning. Well, maybe it's not accidental that I saw that duck just as I was thinking about my father who I went duck hunting with, and, you know, then to turn on the radio and they're playing cartoon music. Oh, wait, it's all happening. There's something about the duck. And, you know, once again, we've all had experiences of dipping into synchronicities, dipping into these deep patterns that seem to imply another level of meaning that's going on in the world. And I want to suggest that is part of the visionary function, or that's part of the visionary faculty, is being able to, or not being able, is seeing those deeper patterns. And so the idea that would go along with kind of supernatural or religious thinking seems very interesting to me, because it also, in addition to being able to make some linkages that are nice, it also gives us a little hint about practice. Because to my mind, one of the things that we're trying to do here is to A, kind of identify what we mean by visionary based on our own experience, based on certain ideas and words, but then also how do we practice with that? How do we cultivate that? Why would we cultivate that? So clearly there's something about cultivating patterns of connection that have to do with the visionary. Of course, this kind of, you know, visionary is also, as I mentioned before, a sort of metaphor for innovation. And that's the kind of popular sense we'll see of it now, where someone comes up with a new way of doing things, a new way of organizing. And it can be very kind of mundane. It's actually sort of charming sometimes, like who gets to be a visionary in the business pages? You know, someone who figures out some new way of like doing, of like moving container ships and, you know, getting some set of objects from this place to that, or how to exploit some peculiarities of an information system online. But there is something about being a visionary, because there's this sense of like a deeper pattern emerging out of a set of possibilities. And what I think that's important to draw out of that idea of innovation as being a visionary is, one, it has to do with an important idea for Terence, novelty, something new. And something new that's not just a specific object, but a new way, a crystallized pattern of doing things. Because the visionary isn't just like, oh, I just want to create a widget. It's usually a much larger scale pattern. Like, you know, we think of like, whatever, Walt Disney as a visionary. Because he wasn't just saying, oh, we could make a park that has stuffed animals in it, walking around, talking to kids. It's a whole idea of a world. We're going to create a whole new kind of world that's also a new kind of industry. Even Ray Kroc with McDonald's, a new way of changing urban space in a way that's not very pleasant, but it is kind of visionary. He kind of figured something out, and it worked out really, really well. So what we can draw from that is it's not just novelty, but it's a world. It's a way of drawing things together. It's a profoundly synthetic, meaning that it's drawing linkages. This quality of the visionary. Another way of thinking about it is the relationship between the visionary and religion or spirituality. And here I'm particularly interested in the way in which the visionary as an idea, as a category, as a way of approaching reality and experience, allows us to sort of to see religion and religious experience and religious prophecy in a new way. That it is a way of acknowledging some of what is so profound and so attractive about spirituality and religion, while avoiding, in some ways, some of the problems that people get into, problems that tend to be around the question of belief. You know, the problem is that a lot of people stumble on is, especially secular people or scientific materialists, but also just in general, is this idea that that you have to believe that the vision of that what's important about Christ's resurrection is that it actually happened, and you're either on the bus or you're off the bus, and we're kind of familiar with that sort of thinking. And then on the other side, you have people who don't even want to pay attention to anything religious. They don't want to know about the deep metaphors in Genesis. They don't want to know about the various visionary interpretations of the Book of Revelation, which is such a visionary document. It's all just junk to them because they don't buy the essential belief. They don't believe in a God, so I don't need to pay attention to any of it. That's part of the sensibility that we see now with contemporary atheism. And I think that appreciating the visionary as a category is a way to bring those worlds together in some sense, or to understand how they can be together. So instead of looking at the Bible as a collection of ossified belief systems, is that it's both a record of visionary experience and itself a kind of visionary poetry, which is a way of looking at these things through a more sort of artistic or poetic or aesthetic sensibility, rather than having them be a claim about the nature of reality. But it's a specific kind of poetry or aesthetic. It's a visionary poetry and aesthetic, and it has its own rules. It has its own sensibility. And I think that once you open up to this quality of the visionary, then suddenly, that's one of the reasons I think a lot of people are so attracted to, I mean, different myth systems and different icons and different sacred sites, is because they feed and magnify our own visionary sensibility. And that there's no, even if we don't believe, it's okay. It's not that, like, wait, why, is this is this the nature of reality that I'm seeing here? No. It can also just be the way that the visionary faculty is fed in us, and the way it is resonates through reality. So you can look at that what these sacred texts are to some degree in mythologies, in more later book-oriented systems like the Bible or the Quran, or if you go even farther, more recent systems where there are, you know, new mystery traditions and new forms of meditation and new systems of the occult. Like, all of this stuff can be seen as different ways of working with, on the one hand, visionary experience, how you actually get into a state where the world appears differently, where perception changes and something new happens, something different happens. And then how you take that visionary experience, or are inspired by that visionary experience, into visionary expression, which might take the form of poetry, it might take the form of art, of iconology, of architecture, of images, any number of things. And so from that perspective, from paying attention to visionary experience and then the kind of poetic expression of visionary experience in these different media and these different forms, suddenly, at least in my experience, a whole new way of looking at religion and spirituality opens up. Where when I go to Burma and go to the Shwedagon Phaya in Yangon, this is one of my favorite sacred sites that I've ever been at. And it's on a hillside, and there's temples all around in kind of a circle, and then there's a central pagoda. And it's just full of these little cupules, and it's like a little city of the spirit. And walking through there, it's like I'm walking through a visionary landscape. It's just that this visionary landscape has been built with material, with objects, with it's fixed in meat space. But it's also a visionary landscape, and it arose out of experiences and intuitions and poems and dreams from a people for hundreds and hundreds of years. And so I don't have to believe or not believe. The visionary allows me to resonate with objects and images in a different way. And I think it also lets us see a little bit more, what are we doing when we turn to religion? Or if we're not, we don't turn to religion, if when we turn to ritual, when we turn to ceremony, when we turn to even the simple acts of what do we wear to a spiritual event or a sacred event, what do we do in the moments before and after meditation, that these very simple aspects of ritual can be seen as ways of invoking this visionary space or this sense of visionary experience. So I want to throw in another word here, because I think that it really helps express even a little more of what I'm trying to get to with talking about the visionary this way. And it's a loaded word, probably even more so than the visionary, and that's the imagination, the imagination. And this the story of this word is also pretty interesting to look how it changes, because in older times, in older periods of history, even in terms of the romantics in the 19th century, the imagination was enormously important. The imagination is a central, pavilion of the landscape, the city of the spirit. And generally, the way we use the word now, it's can be kind of a pain in the ass. Maybe it's a little helpful if you want to be able to be making art or movies or something. But, you know, oftentimes we in our common use of the imagination, it's like, oh, that's just your imagination. You weren't really perceiving reality as it is meant to be. it's a little bit deeper if we turn to the idea of where do ideas come from, where do stories come from, where do, you know, where does a good Hollywood set come from? It's like, oh, well, that person has a lot of imagination. They're able to come up with these things. So that gives us a little stronger sense of it. But it's still mostly just limited to artistic creativity. But there's a much wider way or bigger way of looking at the imagination. One of the persons that I like to turn to here is the English romantic poet Coleridge. And Coleridge is probably, a lot of you know, is famous for his poem Kubla Khan, which itself is a remarkably visionary poem. It is visionary not only in the sense of the exotic landscape that the words conjure. In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, where Alph the sacred river ran through caverns measureless to man, down to a sunless sea. Kind of nifty, kind of springs. You want to be on that river. But it's not just a visionary poem in the sense of an aesthetic judgment about how powerful it is, because it all gets into aesthetic judgments, but it also has a great story attached to it. It's a story, arguably a myth, but, you know, it's got some oomph to it, which is that Coleridge actually had a visionary experience, and this poem was a direct channeling of his vision that was then rudely interrupted by I can't remember what it... Dale, do you remember who interrupts him?
The man from
Porlock.
The man from Porlock.
The insurance. It's like insurance agents. It's the most mundane thing. So for me, this, and then he loses it, and he writes the rest of the poem. But when you read the poem, you can tell where it happens. Like something goes away, and he switches into the past tense in a really interesting way. And you go, oh, something broke there. And what I love about that story is it acknowledges the way that visionary experience continues to flow through the modern world, through the Western world, you know, outside, a world where we no longer have religious prophets. Instead, we have artists and poets, and that they have access, at least they do, maybe we all do, but at least they have access to this kind of visionary experience. But the insurance guy breaking the spell is also a story, you know, an expression of our modern world, where there's something blocking. We have this longing for the visionary, and yet it's difficult for us to get to. We often perceive the world as a very mundane, quotidian place, and it almost constantly sort of interrupts our attempts to generate that deeper sense of enchantment. This is a common thing to say about the nature of modern society, is that it's very disenchanted. And I believe that one of the things that draws people to spirituality and to religion and to poetry and to ritual and to celebration and to crazy parties and to eroticism and lots of the things that draw us is a hunger for the visionary. I think it can also be mistaken, too. I think that we can confuse the visionary for things that are perhaps more profound or have greater claim than they necessarily do. And that some of the delusion, for example, that you see around a lot of religious seeking or spiritual seeking, this kind of either fixity on beliefs or a kind of mini madness that sort of draws people in where they see patterns everywhere, is because they're not really recognizing the specific qualities of the imagination and the visionary that I think are best to be cultivated. So we have issues around this hunger, desire for the imagination for the visionary, and it drives us in many ways. I mean, the whole, you know, industry of Hollywood's and video games can be seen in part as a way of satisfying this desire for the visionary or for the imagination in a way that's, you know, perhaps could be done more artfully in a lot of cases. And so, to my mind, part of what we're doing here is to become a little bit more aware of what this imagination can be and how to cultivate and practice with it. So Coleridge was also a philosopher or a theorist, art theorist, and he put forward the idea that there were two kinds of imagination, the primary and the secondary imagination. And his idea of the primary imagination, he got largely from Immanuel Kant. And Kant was facing this problem of, like, he's thinking, well, you know, however we know things, A couple things can be clear, is that we know them from our own human perspective, with our own human way of perceiving things, where there's time, there's space, there seems to be dimensions, and it's really hard to get out of that. In fact, Kant thought it was as fundamental to the way we perceive, and that you can analyze a number of these different components of consciousness, and that anything you perceived or anything you claimed about the nature of reality was always going to be in the context of these fundamental aspects of human consciousness. But he faced this problem, which is, how does it all kind of come together? Like, I experience one thing. It's all synthesized. You know, I'm here, I'm having a flow. All of these elements are somehow combining. And for Kant and for Coleridge, this is the primary imagination. So the imagination in this view is central. It is what composes our sense of reality. It is what composes our sense of all of these different elements of experience, sensation, thought, memory, time, all of these elements being brought together in our apparently seamless flow of experience. So that's kind of an interesting way, certainly a much larger way of looking at the imagination. And then Coleridge said there's this secondary form of imagination. And this is the imagination a little bit more as we conventionally think about it, artistic imagination. He has this line, I wrote it down because it's pretty good, that the imagination diffuses, dissolves, and dissipates in order to recreate. So it's the idea that on the one hand, it selects elements, possibilities, partial ideas, and then it recreates, it brings them together, it synthesizes them. In some ways, it's a lot like the way dreams work. In a lot of our dreams, if we break them down, we could say, oh, I got that part because at 2 p.m, I was going to go swimming, so then there was the pool, and then that guy mentioned he was watching the science fiction last night, and that's why I saw the spaceship. You can see where a lot of the elements come to, but then it's recreated in something completely novel and sometimes extraordinarily beautiful and meaningful. And so what I like about this way of thinking about the imagination is this two layers, is that there's a deep continuity between them. There's a deep continuity between our creative activities, whether this is in ritual or poetry or other forms of using the imagination in the more conventional sense, and then our deeper, more fundamental sense of just reality itself, of our own experience, of our own minds. Coleridge associated the primary imagination with I am, with that fundamental I am, that basic sense of self that's flowing through reality. And this is why I said at the beginning that on some level, I think the visionary is what we are, that we actually are right now having a visionary experience. And it's constrained in certain ways, and because of our habituation, we see it in certain ways. And that part of what working with the imagination or working with the visionary is starting to move in to that subtle place where ordinary reality and extraordinary reality meet. You know, it's not that difficult. I mean, it can be scary, but it's not that difficult to, take a healthy dose of a plant teacher on and have visions. You know, what we do with them, whatever, and I'll talk about that in a moment. What I think is really interesting is when we get close to the crux of how that the elements of the visionary are always right on the edge of our perception right now. They can be shifted with very subtle cues. And I think a lot of what ritual is, what an attention to ordinary life can be, is a way of cultivating this kind of visionary sensibility. So with that in mind, I want to turn to the idea of practice, the other term in our title, visionary practice. Practice is a marvelous term, and yesterday we're talking about what is, California consciousness, which is a way of saying what is this kind of, I really don't like the term New Age for a lot of reasons, but what is this sort of post-religious, global, interconnected, spiritual seeking about? And what are its elements? I think in one sense it really is about consciousness. I think that's one of the key issues, is what the experience of consciousness is, what it is, how it works, how do we move into that. But I think another really, really important aspect of it that unifies so much of the disparate paths that people follow is this idea of practice. And practice, to me, in one respect, is a rejoinder, once again, to belief. That a lot of the problems people get into, pro and con, when dealing with this stuff, is the idea of belief. If you get it, if you're a meditator, or you do, no, even more, if you do yoga and you talk about the chakras, and you bring that up to a hard-headed scientist, they'll be like, "What are you talking about? There's nothing there. That's just, it's irrational. That's not." So they're not even going to go there, and you're like, "Well, but it's actually an interesting way to experience myself." And how did you get there? By believing, by reading a book and saying, "Oh, that's the system for me." You know, there's seven chakras. No, I don't care about the five chakra system that Tibetans use. There's seven chakras, and they work like this. No, that's not how people do it. That's not what you're practicing yoga, or you're reading a book, and you see this, and then somebody says, "Oh yeah, that's really great. Check it out. Do these meditations." And then over time, as you willingly allow your imagination to interact with your body and with your practice, then phenomena occur. Interesting phenomena, rich phenomena, phenomena that resonates with other things that you've been thinking or other things that you've been reading. And suddenly you go, I know exactly where my fifth chakra is. And I know exactly when it's open and when it's not. And, you know, I'm sitting here talking to the scientist guy and he's, "No, but there's no basis for that." It's like, that doesn't matter to me. I'm not on your map. I'm not believe or not believe. I'm practice. I practice with imagination, and I practice with my body, and certain experiences happen, and I find it rich to continue to practice that way. I need no more justification. And so practice for me is a very, very powerful way of eluding some of the traps of belief and credulity that hover around these issues. And it's also extremely, again, ordinary, because I think a lot of the issues that we face is that we live in an ordinary reality a lot of the time. We feel it's the texture of the mundane, and we can have extraordinary experiences. We can go on fabulous trips. We can have amazing parties. We can have great visionary experiences, but we have the sense of being thrown back into it. And practice is something that builds that bridge, because there's something very ordinary about practice. There's something very sort of at hand to it. You know, I always feel like a kid practicing piano whenever I practice that. And that resonance of those words, I think, is really, really important. So I want to talk a little bit about a couple of different ways of thinking about what is visionary practice or what is imaginative practice. Once again, I'll just bring up the idea of the chakras, because it's something that's everyone is more or less familiar with, and probably most of you who have done meditation or yoga. And it's a really interesting way of thinking about how does it happen? How does it work such that I come to perceive something like my fifth chakra? And one of the ways I think that it's happening is that you're changing your body such that new energies are released, new novelty is occurring in your body. And to the degree that your brain is kind of hardened with certain kinds of habits, and those habits we hold into our bodies, that as you stretch and change and open up, you're actually creating the possibility for something new to happen. And you can experience that simply energetically, simply in terms of the way your skeletal structure distributes weight, about how much tension you hold in your muscles. You can understand it on that level. But then somewhere along the way, you ask the imagination to help do some work. Let's say there's a star opening here. Let's say it's a golden color. Let's say there's a mantra that goes along with it. Sounds good. It hums. I can feel it in my chest cavity. So what I've sort of done is invite a different level of my experience, this sort of imaginative sensibility, the world in which I see faces in trees. From that world, I say, okay, faces and trees world, let's bring a golden sun that I can open up in my heart. And then as I'm doing these other physiological things, a deeper synthesis occurs. And there's something really special about that deeper synthesis. And I think that a lot of the more profound kind of visionary experiences that are accessible in a more or less ordinary state come about for this kind of reason, where there's a coupling of a system of the imagination that has been weaned and winnowed over many, many generations, but also it has a collective quality. If I go off on my own and just say, oh, Keshi, my chakra's over here and it's purple and it looks like an octopus, yeah, maybe that'll work. Probably not. Because part of what I'm tapping into, and here we get a little bit woo, part of what we're tapping into, I believe, is a collective agreement about the way the imagination works. Because the imagination is never just in here. Imagination is rich and thick and dense with the accumulated history of human experience, both the obvious things like architecture and images and books and paintings on the wall and sounds and words and poems, all the stuff that I can take in. But I think on a deeper level, on a more subtle level, the world of the imagination, the world of dreams, has a collective quality. It's partly composed out of all of our experiences and all of our agreements. So when I'm turning to a traditional system, it's not because they're right and the other guys are wrong. It's because there's so much richness there. There's so much density there that I can tap into that and it can enter in and begin to transform my experience. So this is a way of thinking about how yoga works, and I think in general you can see a lot of how magic works that way. I know that Dale's going to talk about magic later, and I'm really looking forward to that very much. From the few little bits he's already given me, I feel a thrill going up and down my spine. But one way of looking at magic, let's say ritual, even ritual magic, because it's a little more obvious, where you're setting up a, let's say calling the quarters, or I'm practicing the banishing ritual of the lesser pentagram, which is a kind of core Western magical rite where you set up a certain space and you draw figures in the air and you call certain names, and as you're doing all this, of course, you're also invoking the imagination, and it's very similar to the yoga, where you're moving your body in a way that creates a space for something new or a new habit, a new kind of way of being in the body. But you're drawing the imagination into it, and that's charging it much more. The same thing when you call quarters. I remember when I used to go to pagan rites and they would call the four directions. With these guys tend to do the six because they're a little bit more native-based, but I was working in more kind of Celtic traditions or fabrications in a lot of ways, because so much of that is newly invented, but that doesn't mean it doesn't work. And that's part of the point. That's part of the point with the imagination. I was like, what are we doing? We're calling these things, and I was so heady about it, like, what, the spirits of the air? What is that? And then I realized it was just this very different energy that was almost, it came more from the heart, and it was kind of almost like a, like will, like when I wanted something, except it wasn't like wanting something, it was like, there! And it totally transformed my experience. And so I think there's a way in which we tap into the energies of the body and certainly the energies of the psyche in order to charge these events and rituals of the imagination. The most obvious energy is eros, is desire. That if you take an imagination or if you take an image in a ritual context, and you bring desire or will to that energy, then suddenly you're really getting something going. And that's part of what's going on with the yoga chakra. It's part of what's going on with any kind of, even the simplest ritual, where I light the candle or the incense and set it before the Buddha before I sit down there. There's a little bit of desire in there. There's a little bit of will. Not the desire the Buddha wants to get you. It's called intention, if you will. But there's a certain charge that goes into that activity. So I think part of the way we practice with the visionary, part of the way we practice with the imagination, is we are aware of what those energies are that we're bringing in, one thing. Two, the body is always involved in some way or another. The body and its physiological energies are always involved. And the psyche is involved, the energies of the psyche. And it's worth it to think of it in terms of energy. And of those, desire, eros, is really the key element. And it's interesting to go back and look in the history of magic, like the ideas about how does magic actually work in a, not stage magic, but the spiritual stuff works. You find these amazing, amazing descriptions of how the mind works. And they're very complicated. I'm not going to go into them, and I can only half remember them anyway, because they're quite, there's quite a lot of them, and they're quite interesting. Going back to Aristotle forward, there's a whole tradition of trying to understand, where do these images come from? Where do these phantasms come from? What's the relationship between the objects that I see in the world and the objects I can imagine with my eyes closed or that I see in my dreams? What's actually making that happen? And we don't know much better now how that works either. But there were these elaborate systems of having this material that was inside, that was associated with the breath, that would get impressed with images, so that phantasms were actually internal images that would work inside of us, and that there was different ways to do different kinds of practices that would charge these phantasms in different ways. But the main energy, the main motive force that was connecting these things, that connected the phantasm in my head to the objects that I saw in the world, to the spirits of the heavens or the planetary bodies, which were all connected in a kind of astrological way, that the energy there was eros. The energy there was desire, was the synthetic element that was holding things together. Very much like the way I was describing visionary innovation as synthetic, or dreams as synthetic. There's this activity of drawing together and fusing and making anew that's fundamental to the visionary. And it has a great deal to do with desire, the desire to bring together, to connect, to bond, to fuse, to become one. And so as we open up, and we have this energy available to us. Part of what love is, when we fall in love, we're ensorcelled. In most people's experience, the closest they come to magic is falling in love. And what's going on there? The image of the other has entered and become a phantasm in my mind, and charging it with this tremendous longing and desire that resonates on all these different levels. So I'm having a theophany when I see the loved one, the same way that, you know, Moses has a theophany of God in the burning bush. A theophany means when you see the divine, when you see God. And so there I am, like, you know, whatever, looking across the lunchroom at Torrey Pines High School, and I'm having his theophany. You know, it's pretty remarkable stuff. That itself is a portal to my mind into the way that the visionary works, where there's a certain quality of desire, a certain quality of attraction, and a certain relationship to the image that's very powerful. I think the last thing I want to talk about, and then we'll open it up to questions. And I'm going to, this afternoon and the later afternoon when I talk, I'm going to speak more specifically about some, what I would call kind of more ordinary visionary practices, ways of drawing some of this energy into your daily life. But the last thing I think I want to talk about here is more the extraordinary visionary practices of associated with plant helpers and medicines. This is kind of a different zone, because there's just so much there. And if most of the time we're on the mundane with little glimpses of the visionary coming through, you know, in these extraordinary states, it's the opposite. We're overwhelmed with the extraordinary, and even a little bit of mundane might help some of the time. And so it becomes a different kind of question of how to practice with these images. But once again, I want to sort of, rather than dive in all the way and talk about what does it mean, what are the nature of these entities, what does it mean when you get a message, there's a lot of things to say there. Before we get in there, I want to spend a little bit of time on this, on the liminal space that we go through to get there. What actually happens? Because one of the great things about these compounds is that when they're first opening up the visionary world, that you can see, if you're paying attention, how visions come. And I think you can also see this in going to sleep sometimes. You can watch, if you're lucky, in a hypnagogic state, how the visionary begins. And because initially there'll be a sort of what you might think of as a kind of neurological fireworks going on. I'll actually use the example of hypnagogy because to me it's a little bit clearer. So I'm going to sleep and I'm like, wow, I'm actually kind of conscious now, even though I'm pretty asleep. Like, I'm pretty asleep now. Oh, this is interesting. Well, what's going on? Phosphine activity. So random squiggles of light. You know, not very interesting, kind of nifty, a little zigzag here and there, maybe a circle. Not much going on. Then suddenly, I'm going to sleep, and then they form a pattern. Okay, oh, it's a triangle. Oh, it forms a basic pattern. Okay, I can see that. And then, this is the interesting part, the triangle goes 3D, and it becomes a pyramid, and I'm on the deserts of Arabia. Well, that was pretty cool. That was moving from randomness, from mere noise, to a kind of pattern recognition, a basic pattern recognition, and then that pattern bloomed into a realm, into a dynamic, visual, interactive realm that if I go deep enough, I'm going to meet other characters in there. And they're going to tell me stuff, and they're going to take me to other realms. It keeps going on and on and on. And I think something similar is that one aspect of the teaching of visionary plants is not that these visions I'm showing you are real. You must take them on. They're your work. Come on. Come back over and over again. Then that's not necessarily what they're teaching. Part of what they're also teaching is just how it is that visions come to be. How it is that your mixture of memory and the mysterious archetypal immensity of the deep visionary realms come to meet on this nervous system in this situation, and how these visions come to be. That part of visionary practice in some ways is disenchanting the visions, not making them meaningless, not saying they're not anything, but understanding how they're constructed. Because the more you understand how they're constructed, how it comes to be, you can cultivate that sensibility in a very ordinary way in your life. And that's my experience, anyway. So I think I'm going to stop there, and I'll talk more about some of that ordinary practice in the afternoon. And I'd like to open up for questions just now, because there might be some questions, and then we might want to talk about how our dreaming went last night.